one of the disadvantages of getting into your 40s and 50s is that you aren't always sure if the reason you think your old ideas are better is just because you're getting old and don't want to change, or if they really were. But I've never quite given up my love for poetry that rhymes, even though some people ridicule it, or if not ridicule it, at least act as if free verse is equally as poetic. And I suppose there is some good free verse that is really poetic, and I am not going to get into that dispute today, but I was glad to see a workshop about powerful rhymed poetry given a slot on the program. There are plenty of handouts if you come in late, or not late, but if you raise your hand. We're not even starting time yet, we're just getting started. So, on the front of the handout, I have a list of some quotations from people that I think are respectable commenters on the field of poetry, and they all support rhyme. I don't know how many of you have come across the name of X.J. Kennedy. He wrote the book I have of his is actually, I think, sort of a pre-publication edition, and I looked up the book in the library that I think is the final version. But anyway, he's a rather well-known name in the field of poetry, and here are a few of his comments. Wit may be driven home without rhyme, he likes to use the other spelling, but it is rhyme that rings the doorbell when she arrives. You just won't be able to get it done. You just won't get into people unless there's some rhyme to go with it. And then he says also, especially I like the last part of this next quote, if successfully employed as it has been at times by a majority of English-speaking poets whose work we care to save, rhyme runs through its poem like a spine. The creature moves by means of it. And thirdly, skillful rhyme, unlike poor rhyme, is never a distracting ornament. Perhaps it's because some people have misused or poorly used rhyme that some people are not so sure that it's a benefit or a positive thing. And Robert Frost is famous for likening writing free verse to playing tennis with the net down. What challenge is there? What's the point? Anybody can bat the words around in any old form. And he says, I've given offense by saying that. And then Stephen Fry is the writer of this book that I introduced in the last period a little bit, The Ode Less Traveled, instead of The Road Less Traveled. And he's a British author, and here are a few quotes of his. When used well, rhyme can reify meaning, and that was a new word to me, so it probably is to some others here, but reify just means to treat something that's an abstraction as if it was material or concrete. And so rhyme can take meaning that has abstractness to it and can actually make it seem like a thing. It can embody in sound and sight the connections that poets try to make with their wider images and ideas. And there are some other ones here that maybe are more meaningful for you read on your own than for me to read them. But I would recommend if you like to collect writings on for your own copies. This man, Bliss Perry, wrote a book called A Study of Poetry. He was a Harvard professor, and it's old enough that it's in the public domain, so you could photocopy the book if you wanted. But I'd like to just read a quote besides the one that's here. After a section on rhyme, this is what he says near the end. Rhyme, then, is not merely a jingle. It is rather, as Samuel Johnson said of all versification, joining music with reason. Putting reason and music together. And the musical sound that we like with skillful rhyme, coupled with the reason of the poetic thought, makes pretty nearly an incomparable beauty, I think. But as came up in the last literature class, not everyone agrees on analysis of literature, and that's actually a hallmark of literature. If it provokes thought that is diverging. So you're in no way obligated to agree with my opinions here today, but we're going to try to look at a few things that go along with rhymes poetry that has power. And some that doesn't. Sometimes one of the ways to most know what we want to do is to have clearly in mind what we don't want to do. But we're going to start with looking at quite a few powerful poems. And on the second page of the packet I gave you, we're going to, we have a list of quite a few poems that, in my opinion, have power, poetic power. And I'd like to first look at the point that says poetic power lies in its ability to connect with the reader's emotions and spirit. And I think that was the subject of the poetry workshop yesterday, at least in part, how the connections that are made. Well, we have to make them or the poetry hasn't done its work. It hasn't been powerful. And to connect with the reader's emotions and spirit, letter A, the subjects that we write upon need to be ones in which people take interest. And I think I mentioned that in the class this morning. One of the things that people are always interested in is the problems of other people. You always like it in a story when somebody's getting into deep, deep trouble. You wouldn't want to be there, but you sure love seeing them there. And we always take an interest in that. Problems, struggles, dilemmas. But we also like hearing people's aha moments, their insights, their aspirations. And I have a few examples of poems here. A Human Dilemma that we talked about this morning that Robert Frost wrote about was the poem Mending Wall. He wrote poetry about how he and his neighbor didn't think about poems the same. If I could put a notion in his head, why do they make good neighbors? Why do you think that way? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Why do you think a wall is important? And we like to read poetry that has people at least mentally arguing with each other. And he ends up still poking fun at his neighbor. He likes having fault of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. And we enjoy reading the disparity of thought between Frost and his neighbor. So relating to neighbors, that's the kind of thing we enjoy reading about. Or how others apply God's grace. Next poem here, Looking Unto God. I look to thee in every need and never look in vain. And, you know, this kind of poem is maybe just what it will take to reassure us that we're going to be taken care of this time, just as we have been before and before and before. It connects with us because it's a struggle we have. Or the elegy written in a country churchyard that we talked about in class this morning, the idea that there are human differences. Some are rich, some are famous, some are strong leaders, others die practically unknown. Very few people coming to their funerals. There are those differences. And does it matter? And what do we think about it? And what should we derive from it? Lessons like that. This poet is musing about the poor that were buried in the churchyard and comparing their lives with the lives of famous men like Milton and Cromwell. And he makes some very good conclusions that even brings it down to when he dies. We like to read about things in which we could put our own name. Sometimes it's the humorous side of life that catches our attention and connects with our spirits. I talked about the poem that Robert Frost wrote, Brown's Descent. That was an accident. A man got caught by the wind and blew him out on the ice, and down the hill he went and went and went and went. And we enjoy reading about humorous accidents, or idiosyncrasies, queer thoughts that people have, and queer habits they have, or quotes from little people, you know, like this one, "Not Worth Your Salt." That's one of Jam's editors. How many of you know that poem? I'll read it to you then. "One day, as I was putting on a chicken for our dinner, I looked around and couldn't seem to spot the salt container. I then remembered it upstairs because the night before we made the salt and water drink for throats that were so sore, I told my little son of two to go upstairs and get it, and please be careful on the stairs so that you won't upset it." I don't think it was a shaker. I think it was a baking container. "He ran with eager little feet, his mission to fulfill. The crash and wail that I soon heard bespoke to me a spill. I hurried over to the stairs, and all that I could see was salt from halfway down the steps to right in front of me. The salt was mingled with the dirt and stuff upon the floor. I knew the best thing I could do was sweep it out the door. Lifting my head to look upstairs and spot the one at fault, I shook my head and sadly said, 'You are not worth your salt.'" We like typical little everyday accidents like that, and cute things that little children say, and human foibles. Here's one by Robert Frost called "Not All There." "I turned to speak to God about the world's despair, but to make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me, don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there, at least not over half." But we do laugh. Human foibles, human weaknesses. People will enjoy reading poems about those because they love hearing that other people have the same problems they do and are the same queer things that they are. People enjoy, they will connect with poems about analogies between common and abstract things. In fact, that's one thing I mentioned in this morning's class, that's one thing that's behind a good poem. Someone that can think creatively and make connections that most people never even thought of. This poem makes, and this doesn't connect with American life, but for some cultures it would. The camel kneeling down to have his burden lifted off, and then he kneels at break of day, and his guide replaces the load, and the person makes the connection between, that's how we should do. Release our burden into the Lord's hands at night, take it up again the next day, and be sure that he won't give us anything more than we can bear. So that's out of our culture, but you know, there are things that we can draw from animals, plants, in our own culture that are meaningful. Here's one that I wanted to double check, and I didn't get it done. Something seems to be missing here in the poem. I have a couple with me, I could look. But you read it while I'm looking, see if you can get anything out of it. No, I think it's right. But I'll have to puzzle it over a little bit more to get quite all the flow together. But the point was, he smelled something, and sure enough, he saw an apple tree that had just unloaded apples, and the ground was one circle of solid red. And then he exclaims, "May something always go always unharvested. May much stay out of our stated plan, apples or something forgotten and left, so smelling their sweetness would be no theft." In other words, may something always be left in a condition that you wouldn't think would be ideal to bless the lives of those who come along. And, you know, that's rather abstract, something that most people don't think about, but it gives you something to think about and decipher for a good while. What could that mean in my life? I like this one. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Greek language. I am a bit. He says, iota, we use the word in English, we call it an iota, but that comes from the tiniest Greek letter character that looks a little bit like a backwards J, comes down with a little hook, and sometimes they tuck it under the letter eta, and it's called an iota subscript. And it's the same as our letter I. So he plays on, he uses a pun here, seek not in me, the big I, capital, nor yet the little dotted in me seek. If I have in me any I at all, 'tis the iota subscript of the Greek. I'm with you underneath. So small am I as an attention beggar. The letter you will find me subscript to is neither alpha, eta, nor omega, but upsilon, which is the Greek for you. Upsilon is the name of their character that makes the oo sound. And we would say it U, and we would spell it U. It's just so full of meaning. I could talk about it for a long time. We could think about it for a long time. Human relations is what that one's about. And he bases it on some alphabet letters in another language. The poetic field is really wide open, isn't it? Fourth, connecting with readers' emotions and spirits, sometimes it's inspirations to which other people can relate, such as the poem To a Waterfowl that some of you are probably familiar with. And especially that becomes interesting when you read the story behind William Cullen Bryant. He was on his way from home, and he was walking, he was a New Englander, and he was walking across the New England hills to a little distant village where he was going to take up a job. And it was on that walk to his first job, if I'm not mistaken, that he caught sight of a waterfowl flying. I don't know what it was. Heron? I don't know. And derived the inspiration from that scene to write about how, you know, he's going to be guided just as surely through the way that he treads the line as the bird was guided in the sky through the abyss of heaven, through the rosy depths. And it's a beautiful bit of poetry. And sometimes we might have to sort of use some imagination if that particular bird or seashore or whatever it is in nature is not part of our life. But if it's done well, it can be inspirational to a lot of people, because all of us have sometimes felt as if we were out in an abyss and needed some guidance. Or the poem Out in the Fields with God. We sing that sometimes. And I would hope you've all had an opportunity to be somewhere, just you and God, whether it was while you were in a field doing work, or whether it was in a woods or down by the ocean or somewhere. And people can connect with a message of inspiration that comes out of nature, because we all have those kinds of opportunities. Maybe it's an inspiration on the efficacy of prayer. Here are a couple of poems. Because we do not see. The weary one had rest. The sad had joy that day and wondered how. A plowman singing at his work had prayed, Lord, help them now. That's how they had it. Away in foreign lands, they wondered how their feeble words had power. At home, the Christians two or three had met to pray an hour. Yes, we are always wondering how, because we do not see someone, unknown perhaps, and far away, on bended knee. And then, you know, somehow it sinks into us that, well, maybe that's why my day didn't go any worse than it did. Or, you know, it's an inspiration that connects with everybody's life. It's so common to man that surely there'll be someone in the audience of readership that will be glad for that inspiration. Or it could be meditations on the Lord's return, because we all know we're facing that. Or it could be commentary on current or famous events, like this one on the convergence of the twain. Does anyone know the date when that was written? How close was that to the sinking of the Titanic? Does anyone know? I don't. But I've done the same thing. When Y2K was coming up, I read this one, The Millennial Muse. I probably was a little more impressed with that event than some people. I made a collection of millennial items, and I even invited my students in for the night, and we had a singing over the midnight stroke, and I was really impressed with that current event, so I did something about it. I wrote a poem. I wrote a poem when the Columbia blew up over Texas. And sometimes, if those poems are issued right away, don't always get that done. But if they are, well, they will connect with people because they've lived through the same thing you did. So that's one way that we may connect. We write about things that others will take interest in. And when we don't, that's all right, but we just may not be able to ever realize it's having been so powerful. The second one here, poetic devices that we employ, and I really wasn't going to spend much time talking about the devices, but I listed a few here. They need to accent the spirit and the message of the poem. First of all, rhythm devices. We're all familiar with the 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2 type thing of poetry. G.C. Waldrick mentioned that I had mentioned the spondee this morning, and then he introduced the molossus that I wanted to mention too, but we'll get to that after a while. And there are some more. Can somebody tell what we mean by enjambment? What's that device about? Yes.
Is it the where the end of one line is the beginning of the next line? Like she, Marlene read that poem about the pool players yesterday.
Oh.
And yeah, like. Mm-hmm. You end a sentence partway through a line and start another one, and that sentence does not end until the next stanza.
All right, or line. Yes, it comes from the French, and I think that actually means to stride over or something. You just keep going at the end of the line as if you didn't know that the end of the line came, and you go right into the next line. And I heard from people that were working with a hymn book that they don't really like that in hymns very well. But, so that might be one modification you'd have to write if you were writing a hymn poem. But for general poetry, I'd like to read to you a little bit from this book on the Ode Less Traveled, what he has to say about enjambment and caesura. A caesura is a pause partway through the line. It might be marked by a comma, or it might not be, but you just know that to bring out the thought, you're going to have to take a little wee mini pause here to make the flow of words convey what the poet wanted you to. And those two things, he says, should not... Well, let me just read. He says it very effectively. The fact is, enjambment and caesura, these two, what should we call them? Techniques, effects, tricks, devices, tools, however we describe them, are crucial liberators of the iambic line, that 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. After a while, it's going to get plodding and monotonous. So he says they're crucial liberators. They either extend, like the enjambment, or break, as the caesura, the flow, allowing the rhythms and hesitations of human breath, thought, and speech to enliven and enrich the verse. They are absolutely not a failure to obey the rule of pentameter. He goes on saying about, he gives some examples here, and in which the line ran into the next line. And he says, now, this arrangement, if you would divide it up so that the thought ended at the end of the line, would enable us to end stop in our heads or out loud as we read the verse. Surely that's a better way of organizing things, you know, stop at the end with your thought and at the end of the line. That is the sense, after all, so why not therefore break the lines accordingly? Why not stop your line where the thought stops? This is the 21st century, isn't it? And he says, no. And then he uses an expletive, no. 1,000 times no. The organizing principle behind the verse is not the sense, but the meter. And then he goes on to talk about that. He says, but why would you say that the meter of the poem is what you organize around instead of the sense that you're talking about? Well, then he says this. Well, painters paint within a canvas, and composers within a structure. It is often the feeling of the human spirit trying to break free of constrictions that gives art its power and its correspondence to our lives, hedged in as ours are by laws and restrictions imposed both from within and without, so that if you lock yourself into a meter and cut the line off, even if the sentence isn't finished, and move on to the next line, there's something about that cut, that restriction to the meter, that actually makes you want to get into the next line and keep on and gives the power to the poem. And so those types of poetic devices, rhythm devices, at the right spot are just the touch you need to make things feel tense or relaxed or whatever. And then, of course, there are vocabulary choices, and there are sound devices. How many of you are familiar with Poe's poem on the Raven? Once upon a midnight dream. Okay. I want to just read you an excerpt from that one. It's down in verse 3. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, 'tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, this it is, and nothing more. Now, how about that silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain? Doesn't that just sound a little bit creepy to go along with the creepy feel of the Raven? It does to me. He brought those sound devices in just perfectly. And of course he uses a lot of internal rhyme too. And we're going to come to one place in the poem later in the class that I'm getting sort of daring, but I'm actually saying that Poe didn't do a very good job at one spot. Another thing that, there are many things that will end in, that could be said under letter B, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on devices right now. This poem that begins at the bottom of page 2 is written by Gerard Manley Hopkins, a famous poet of the UK, and it is so difficult to understand because of all the non-words. I went to the public library. I thought maybe I could find a dictionary of the Scottish language. Well, they didn't seem to have that, but the reference librarian actually went to printed out something for me from a university study of the poem, I guess, that has a glossary of this. So I incorporated some of the ideas from their printout to help you understand some of the words that have the little circles after them. And I'm going to read it to you, and as I come to these strange words, you can maybe glance to the right and see in italics what some of these things might mean. Yes.
What does the title mean?
It's the name of a place in Scotland, Inversnaid, I guess. I don't know how it's pronounced, but it's a Scottish location name, evidently, that impressed him. And he's writing about a brook, and he says, this darksome burn, horseback brown, his roll rock high road roaring down, and the high road means this path that the brook is following as he comes down off the heights. And it's roll rock because it's swift enough to roll rocks. But that is not a word. He loved to coin words, and it actually makes it a bit difficult. But hold on, there's a reason I'm going through all this. His roll rock high road roaring down, in coupe and in cone, the fleece of his foam flutes, and low to the lake falls home. A wind-puffed bonnet of fawn froth turns and twindles over the broth of a pool so pitch black, fell frowning, it rounds and rounds despair to drowning. Dagged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through, and the second thing that is soaked with dew are wiry heath packs, third, flitches of fern, and fourth, the bead bonny ash that sits over the burn. And then he comes into standard language and says, what would the world be once bereft of wet and of wildness? Let them be left. Oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet. And I just love that conclusion. He does about everything that he can in that last verse after he pulls you through all that massive unfamiliar language, but he's trying to communicate with it, and if you take the time to figure it out, it's actually sort of beautiful. But then he breaks out in this exclamation that we can all understand with alliteration and passion and color. What would the world be if you couldn't see a dew-soaked landscape and a tumbling brook that's rolling the rocks and let them be left, he says. Wildness and wet. Long live the weeds in the wilderness yet. He made prime use of sound devices and rhythm devices to make the climax memorable. So he wants you to enjoy his inspiration with this wild rolling brook. And to do it, he leads you through all kinds of imaginative things in your mind, and then uses some alliteration of W to go with the water and wildness, and really emphasize the climax. So the devices that are employed can't just be anywhere or in any amount. They need to be well chosen, and it would be interesting to know how many versions he may have worked on until he had it just the way he wanted it. Poetry, thirdly, connects with readers by producing memorable mental pictures or definite, fresh impressions. Up here I have the little chorus. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. What if the poet had written something like I have in the right-hand side? What would have been different? It fits the rhythm. Tells us to do the same thing. But what's wrong?
It's the way everybody else has been saying it for 100 years or more.
All right. Yes. I am told exactly what to do. Turn, not your head, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And I can visualize doing that. And it produces a mental picture that I still like, and I think readers and singers will like for many years after they have first met this. Turn your eyes, look full, and while that's happening, you'll notice that the stuff that you looked away from is starting to just be less and less noticeable. And it's very well said. The second example comes from this poem, An Apple Orchard in the Spring. And it's a quote from verse 2. Have you plucked the apple blossoms in the spring? In the spring? And caught their subtle odors in the spring. Pink buds pouting at the light. Crumpled petals, baby white, just to touch them a delight in the spring. What if instead of saying pink buds pouting at the light, it would have said fresh buds seeking warmth and light? What's wrong there? What's memorable about this?
It's fresh and unique.
And what?
It's fresh and unique.
It's unique, yes. What has it given to the buds that the right-hand column?
Personification.
Pink buds. Still unused to things, they pout when you disturb them. Pink buds pouting at the light. Crumpled petals. Baby white. Just as fresh as you could ask for. Creating memorable mental pictures. The first way you think of saying it probably won't be the best. Keep exploring. Turn something into something better. Or this familiar one from Maltby Babcock's poem, "Only Be Strong." He said it well when he said, "Enfold the hands and acquiesce." Oh, shame. He's telling you what people might actually physically do. So, well, I don't know. I guess I'll wait and see. And he tells you an actual posture to assume. Or that they assume. Specificness. Shape definite images and moods for powerful poetry. Or, number two, make reference to familiar objects or occurrences. Again, things that will make pictures. Wherefore, let thy voice rise like a fountain. About every week I drive by a fountain. And I just don't get tired of looking at fountains. They're so graceful. And when it gets hot, they invite you in. They're just so pretty. Let your voice just gush upward like that. For me, night and day, I can think of an object. John Greenleaf Whittier's one next. Health that mocks the doctor's rules. Knowledge never learned of schools. That's in the poem, The Barefoot Boy. And mocking the doctor's rules. Such as, give me an example, what might he have had in mind? Well, anyone?
If you've ever read the poem Strictly Germ Proof, it makes a lot of fun out of all the sanitation concerns in our day, which they're valid concerns, but they can take it overboard.
All right, so that's an example. All right, and then there's a poem that I'd like to read to you of Robert Frost's called Tree at My Window. And again, it's familiar objects or occurrences. I don't know how many of you have an upstairs bedroom window with a tree nearby, but that seems to be the setting. Tree at my window, window tree. My sash is lowered when night comes on. But let there never be curtain drawn between you and me. Vague dream head lifted out of the ground, and thing next most diffused to cloud. Not all your light tongues talking aloud could be profound, but tree, I have seen you taken and tossed, and if you have seen me when I slept, you have seen me when I was taken and swept and all but lost. That day she put our heads together, the tree's head and mine. Fate had her imagination about her. Your head so much concerned with outer, mine with inner weather. Isn't that gorgeous? Everybody knows what a tree whipping around looks like, and tree outside my window, you whip around out there and I whip around in bed. We will connect with readers when we take familiar objects and make such connections. Or number three, sometimes it's allusion to either some well-known scripture or some literary gem, and we just pass across it in our writing, and everybody connects with it because it's familiar. When Whittier wrote in his poem, The Eternal Goodness, "And if my heart and flesh are weak to bear an untried pain, the bruised reed he will not break, but strengthen and sustain." And Bible readers know he's alluding to Isaiah. On the bruised reed he will not break. And if it's a person who appreciates the Bible, that passing allusion will connect because, oh yeah, I know what he means. He didn't even say it, but he's letting me figure it out. And we're pulled into the meaning. All right. Part two. We're looking at poetic power. We were looking at it coming from its ability to connect with readers. But it drains away if we do some things that are listed here. And I probably should go across this rather rapidly so I don't sound too critical. And so we have time for part three. But if we cling to outmoded expressions, and I have some examples here, or whosoever, whence, behoove, trod, and what is particularly grievous is when people use trod in the present tense instead of tread. But that gets done partly because that's not our word today for walking. Oh, tis wrought, behold, wended, sought. When we get into the old archaic terms, we have to be aware that we're going to lose some interest, we're going to lose some meaning with some people. We might even not use the word properly. So we should use them sparingly, if at all. And then some more, number two, especially some nouns of yesteryear. How many children growing up in our churches would know what a bark is, meaning a boat, if somebody wouldn't tell them? I mean, whoever uses that in talking with one another. And here are some other ones, too. Could you give me some more that maybe you think should be weeded out of poetry? I'll jot some down. It might make a person just call it wheelbarrow and go on. They won't know what it means. It is not something they don't know about. It's not powerful. It doesn't say anything. I heard one speaker, or else read his writing, and said that, you know, people today might not know a billow from a hay bale. You know, what are billows? Most of us don't live along the sea anyway. So evidently he felt that that was a term we could weed out. And then letter B are some cliched figures of speech or hackneyed expressions. These, by calling them these, that name, those names, I'm not saying that the idea is a bad one. The arms of Jesus are wonderful things. And sweet rest and taking things to heart, they're wonderful things. Can we say them fresh ways, though, to arrest thought instead of harden to something that's stale? Are there any other ones that come to your mind that we could, as a class, add to the list? We're looking at things that subtract power. Well, you'll probably think of more sometime or other, or could easily. It's just, I know on the spot, we can't always come up with something. The third one we want to avoid, it drains away if poets apply rigid rules when breaking them would be more natural or effective. And if I were teaching poetry to my eighth grade students, I might skip this idea because they have to learn to use the rules first. But you remember I talked a bit ago about delivering rhythm from iambic regularity. Sometimes iambic, that 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, that rhythm most naturally matches our natural rhythm of speech in English. That's why it gets used so much. But there are some enrichments, such as a trochaic substitution, when the first foot of the line, instead of starting out 1-2, and then 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, it goes 2-1, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, and that's very effective if you're emphasizing something right at the beginning of the line. You put an accent syllable on it, and it really doesn't disturb the flow significantly. or a weak ending to the line, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, but don't end on 2, and then have an extra 1. That's called a weak ending. But sometimes that's exactly the effect you want. Or a pyrrhic substitution, in which there are 3 unaccented syllables in a row, and you can trip across them. Maybe 2 of them are very short and easily said words, and the feeling is exactly, it puts the accent instead where you really want it, instead of on where the iambic regularity would put it. And number 2, as another example, rollicking, regular, anapestic, 1-1-2, 1-1-2, 1-1-2, 1-1-2. Look at this poem by Tennyson. Here's the molasses. Break, break, break on thy cold gray stones, O sea, and I would that my tongue could utter the thoughts that arise in me. As the sea is there, pound, crash, crash. He says, break, break, break. Cold, gray, stones. Those 3 hammers coming down, that's a technique called molasses. It's spelled just like colossus, except it's molasses. So I redid this poem, the first 2 lines, in anapestic. And the power drains away. This is what I wrote. Oh, the vengeance of violent water that erodeth thy boulders, O sea, and I would that my tongue could utter the thoughts that arise in me. Doesn't have the effect. Pound, 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 it needs to be. And it matches the subject perfectly. So after you've written a number of poems, you can try some of those deviations for the effect, the power that it will have. And you'll still have a rhyming rhythmic poem. Another thing that can drain power away is when we grope for proper rhymes and rhythm in both hit and miss. Here's an example. And the next number of slides are going to be actual poems that were published in one plain paper or another. And they come from various companies, and the point is not to pin anybody down. I just would like to use them as examples. I would call this first one an example of a stale rhyme. Notice that we have day rhyming with way, not only here, but also here. And because of the usefulness of those 2 words and the simpleness of their ideas, they probably get overused. And there are lots and lots of long A sounds in words that we could probably go somewhere else for more variety. Or some more would maybe be words like me and thee and see. And you know, there are so many thoughts that we can use those words for, and they're so useful, but they become stale. Or maybe even worse is what I've called sore thumb rhymes. Can you all read verse 2? Well, maybe we should read verse 1. Like a crown upon a hilltop, like a fringe across the plain, like a million gems bedazzled is bright autumn's golden rain. Like a flaming fire of color, like an artist's expert touch, are the hues of rustic crimson in a gay and catching clutch. Now, everything is fairly rhythmic and well rhymed there, but catching clutch. If something clutches it, it does probably catch it. And somehow it sounds forced to me. It sounds as if someone did need a rhyme with touch, and so they found it. But didn't necessarily say anything that meant so much. Maybe this isn't really rhyme. I was wondering about rustic crimson. I guess, I don't know, maybe that color could be rustic. But we, in our desire to get things to work out and fit it, fill in within the constraints we have, we sometimes get desperate. But we best just live with our desperation a little longer. On this one, this is a cry of to the Lord for one's child, a son. Long years I taught him daily at my side, joined heart with heart, his thoughts he would confide. And now, O Father, as in prayer we meet, make him to know my love for him replete, enclose him in thy heart with tender care, supply his every need, O Father, there. Do you hear a rhyme that sounds forced, sticks out a little bit? And please, I want you to recognize that I would not want to put all my poems on a screen for analysis either. So, I don't want this to sound ugly, but isn't there something forced here?
Is it the last one?
The last?
You had to add O Father and kind of pause and something strange.
All right. The O is frequently put in as a stuffer. That's coming in the next one. I was thinking of this word there. I wasn't sure what the word there, what it meant. Is it Father there up in heaven that I'm praying to? Or is it Father there wherever my son is? Or what's the there? I'm not sure if it meant anything.
It's in the Father's heart.
In
it
the
says,
Father's
enclose
heart.
Him in thy heart with tender care, supply his every need, a Father there, in the Father's heart, in the Lord's heart.
Enclose him in thy heart with tender care. Well, but look at that semicolon. Isn't that starting a new thought here? Enclose him in thy heart with tender care. Oh, I see. Then as he's in your heart, his needs will be supplied there. Oh, all right. All right. Okay. So maybe there's something there that's not a rhyme problem, just maybe needs a little restructuring or something. All right. That makes more sense to me now. All right. Next, stuffed lines sometimes take away power. We can often tell when someone basically needed another syllable and added an O or added a does in front of a verb that was not emphatic. It was just a space filler. Or here's one that uses, oh yes, tis true. Well, if tis true, then we probably don't have to say oh yes. I think that's in there somewhat for filler. And I have a misprint here at the top of page 5. I have... this is where I was going to pick on Edgar Allan Poe's poem on the Raven, and I have The Bleak November, and I wrote that before I checked, and it was December, so that's a mistake on my part. But he says, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December. Do we ever put the in front of month names? I planted garden in the April. I think that feels like a stuffed word. A stuffed line. But anyway, we just need to realize that takes away some of the joy and the power and the effectiveness when we resort to those techniques. Letter E, improper syntax or vocabulary. And to some people, that's not going to matter. It sticks out to me because of my bias toward language. Here's an example. Can someone see what is incorrect grammar, not incorrect syntax in the last verse? Dear Father, calm these longings, still my soul. Keep reading.
Is it the pronoun us? It says, still my soul, and then in rap, us.
Oh, well, yeah, that is some, that's not the problem I had in mind, but you're right. Yeah, if you're speaking of singular things, then it should stay singular. All right? Here's the problem that if you listen, you'll often hear people speak a subordinating conjunction clause, an adverb clause, and never finish it. Then, when at last I kneel in awe and worship at thy throne, what will happen? It never says. And if someone is carefully trying to follow your thought, they'll realize it isn't there. And, of course, then that subtracts power. This poem also illustrates, number two, a malapropism, a word used at a place where an almost a like word should have been used. Replete is not the word for that. And now, O Father, as in prayer we meet, make him to know my love for him complete. Yes. Well, maybe they were just trying to get a less familiar word. Well, I think if you check the dictionary, you'll find that replete doesn't mean what would fit there. So that's a simple matter. Just make sure we're familiar with the words we use. Here's a poem that uses spurn instead of... instead of neglect. With houses, health, and hearty fare, and comfort zones we live, to hungry, sick, and needy souls we spurn our love to give. Spurn means to reject, turn away from. Well, we turn away from them, but we don't turn away from... It's a little bit awkward to say we turn away from our love to give. It means more the idea of neglect. So we just want to watch out for spots like that. Or here in this stanza, I think they mean fill instead of fulfill. Now here. Oh, will I do my little part and fulfill his blessed will? I guess you can fill God's will in a sense. Fill up the measure of it. So that's what this point's about. One more yet. And right here is in stanza four. It's a poem about children playing at recess. Would we actually accomplish more if we would skip our recess or we'd just stay seated all the while and study in a fervent style? Fervent has too religious of a connotation for children studying in school, if I know anything. Fervent's just a little bit too spiritual of a sound for that exercise there. So we have to watch the choices of words, or we might drain away the power. All right, section three. Rhyme gives poetry its greatest power when it feels original, natural, even indispensable. And X.J. Kennedy again says, what matters to rhyme is freshness, not of a word, but of the poet's way of seeing. There are only so many ways to say things, and after a while we will need to duplicate some things. But maybe we can have a fresh way of seeing so that even though I have to use a common word, it still breathes some fresh air. Here's a poem by William Blake, a piece of one. The angel, I forget if it was the whole thing or part of one. The angel that presided over my birth said, little creature formed of joy and mirth, go love without the help of anything on earth. Now, those words are not new, and possibly many people have used some of those rhymes, but the idea is certainly original. So there is more than one way to use rhyme originally and powerfully. Number two, we talked about these overworked rhymes already. Here are some examples. If you have be, do you have to use the common words like see and thee? Or what about agree, decree, debris, trustee, potpourri, or devotee? And you say, well, they don't have anything to do with being or seeing. You might be surprised. In fact, as I thought about that, some things started popping into my mind. Debris doesn't have to mean what's left after a tornado. It could be the earth trash that clutters our lives, the debris that's constantly assaulting us. And that could rhyme with a very religious thought that ends with thee. Or maybe potpourri could be used to mean pleasant scents in a metaphorical way, you know, as God smelled a sweet incense, the sweet savor of incense coming up to him, a potpourri of a life. There are, in fact, I think sometimes if you expose yourself to a rhyming dictionary's possibilities, it might actually spawn a little bit of thought. Oh, maybe I could use that and say this. But of course, you have to use a rhyming dictionary carefully because you don't want to sound the way you would not sound or should not sound. Number three, another way that originality can come, rhyme schemes don't necessarily always need to be cross-rhyming, you know, A, B, or A, B, B. The stopping by woods on a snowy evening is an interesting rhyme scheme. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. Here, my little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. It picks up the odd rhyme of the verse before and uses it for the common rhyme of the next verse. Very interesting. You can be original that way if you can't necessarily choose original looking words. Number four, sometimes originality is marked by a level of surprise. Maybe it's because you said something in the next line that nobody had the briefest inkling was coming. I like this quote from Alexander Pope. He was criticizing lack of originality. He says, wherever you find, in a poem this means, the cooling western breeze, in the next line it whispers through the trees. If crystal streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the reader's threatened, not in vain, with sleep. In other words, you meet this word, you're sure to get this thought. Well, we can be original by breaking into potpourri instead of thee. Say something different. Oh, you probably would enjoy, while we're talking about being original. A cliché. A cliché is what we all say when we're too lazy to find another way. And so we say, warm as toast, quiet as a mouse, slow as molasses, quick as a wink. Think, is toast the warmest thing you know? Think again, it might not be so. Think again, it might even be snow. Soft as lamb's wool, fleecy snow, a lacy shawl of new-fallen snow. Listen to that mouse go scuttling and clawing, nibbling and pawing. A mouse can speak, if only a squeak. Is a mouse the quietest thing you know? Think again, it might not be so. Think again, it might be a shadow. Quiet as a shadow, quiet as growing grass, quiet as a pillow or a looking glass. Slow as molasses, quick as a wink. Before you say so, take time to think. So, originality might be in what we liken things to, might be the way we arrange our sounds. Number five, I have printed this poem titled Tom Darling, and I'm not going to take time to read it, but this poem is peppered with almost two dozen puns, and some of them are truly clever. And I'm not upholding this as a good poem, but I would just invite you to try this kind of technique here and there for original delight. It's describing Tom. His father, verse 2, was an austere man, an oyster man was he, who opened life by opening the shellfish of the sea. And they just do that almost every verse. And you can turn words in, you can turn expressions end for end sometimes and say really interesting things, and your readers will enjoy the word tricks. But we didn't have a bell, did we? Our time's gone, isn't it? Did we have a bell? I think it's supposed to be 3:35. All right, well, a rhyme should also be natural, and it should be indispensable. I'd like to just give you two more examples in relation to rhyme being natural. Natural rhyme should occur on accented syllables. Here's a place where it does not. This is Alfred Tennyson. And some of you might know the poem that he wrote called The Brook. And Brook is I in this poem. I murmur under moon and stars in brambly wildernesses. I linger by my shingly bars. I loiter round my cresses. Now, you either have to say wildernesses, or if you say wildernesses, then it doesn't rhyme with cresses. And something just doesn't quite click right there. But rhyme on accented syllables feels the natural way. Slant rhyme, maybe, can be natural, but mostly if your reader can feel that there wouldn't have been any other word fitting here. But again, in that same poem, he used a slant rhyme that I don't think is indispensable. He says about this brook, I slip, I slide, I gloom, my glance among my skimming swallows. I make the netted sunbeams dance against my sandy shallows. Swallows and shallows, that's a slant rhyme, half rhyme. I think he could have done something else. Shallows can go by more than one name, and would it have had, well, skimming swallows, not all birds do skim across the water like swallows, but you don't want to use a slant rhyme if you can help it, unless that's going to be your pattern, and you develop enough beauty in the consonants or assonants. Well, I need to stop. I don't want to interfere with the next schedule, thing on the schedule, but did anybody have any thoughts or questions here before we stop? Yes.
What word would you replace ferment with?
Fervent? Well, I'm not sure if I'm good enough to say immediately. I think I could do it, but I might have to think it over. Somebody else have an idea?
If you said in study in consistent style or study in an eager style, how would that help?
Eager doesn't work for school children either. Especially if they miss the recess.
Well, I've always liked to do my own writing over editing. I'd rather write originally than edit other people's, but I don't know. Offhand, I can't come up with anything good.
Would dogged work? Study in a dogged style?
Oh, all right. I like that. Plug it away, see if you like it or not. Yeah, that might fit. All right. Well, thank you very much for your attention and your excuse.